dressed and wearing a chauffeur's cap. Parked behind him was a Rolls-Royce. In his arms he held a box from the Neiman Marcus department store, beautifully wrapped in blue foil and decorated by two sequined spheres, one colored like the earth, the other like the moon. When Marilyn looked closer, she could see a little toy spaceship hovering over the lunar surface. Opening the box, she moved aside tissue paper, decorated with silver stars, and found a mink jacket. The best part was the card. It read, "To Marilyn, from the man in the moon." Marilyn put the jacket on over her pajamas and set about tidying the house, her feet hardly touching the ground as she twirled to dust shelves, glided to straightened pillows. Perhaps inspired by the emotions of the day, her 13-year-old son, Jay, kissed his mother for the first time since he'd been in grade school. A few hours later, the Lovells were in church. Although temperatures in Houston were heading into the mid-60s, Marilyn wore her new mink jacket. 2-year-old Jeffrey, dressed smartly in a tan coat and a hat with a chin strap, brought along his toy helicopter, which broke while he squirmed during the service. His sister helped calm him by walking him outside. Valerie Anders also took her children to church. All her boys were dressed in suits, and her 10-year-old son, Glenn, served as altar boy. During services, Valerie gave thanks for Bill's successful departure from the moon and prayed for a safe return to Earth. By this time, the astronauts' families had composed Christmas wishes for their husbands, which Carr delivered by radio to the crew 209,000 miles away. He spoke first to Lovell. "Christmas morning around your house was kind of quiet," says Marilyn. She said that they're all thankful the mission has gone so great. "They missed having you around the tree this morning, but they wanted to reassure you that your presents are waiting, and the roast beef and Yorkshire pudding will be on the table when you get home." "Hey, that sounds good, Jerry. Good old roast beef and Yorkshire pudding," Lovell said. "Hi, Frank," Carr said, now speaking to Borman. "Christmas morning has come at the Borman house, and the boys and Susan and your mom and dad all send their love. They say for you to stay in there and pitch." These words meant a great deal to Borman. That had been his father's motto during the Depression, after he'd lost his gas station lease and things looked bleakest for the family, when he'd taken two jobs, changing tires and driving a laundry truck. In a more private time, Borman might even have cried, thinking about all his dad meant to him. But here, on a mission, he remained a commander. "Okay, thank you," he radioed back to Houston. "Please reciprocate for me." Carr had a message for Anders, too, but Anders was sleeping and would get his later. Apollo 8 coasted for another 2.5 hours, its velocity dropping as lunar gravity continued to act on the ship. At a distance of about 39,000 miles from the moon was the equigravisphere, the point at which Earth's gravity became dominant. Home was still 200,000 miles away, but now the spacecraft began to fall faster, a gradual acceleration that would take it to a speed in excess of 24,500 miles per hour at re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. But that was a long way off, and for now, when the crew looked out their windows, with no landmarks in sight, they seemed to be standing still. A little more than an hour after crossing the Earth-Moon gravitational divide, the astronauts began to prepare for the first of two television broadcasts scheduled for the return journey. Before showtime, Capcom Mike Collins settled some business. He started by delivering a Christmas message to Anders, who'd finally awoken. "Valerie said to tell you that she and the kids are leaving for church about 11:30 and eagerly awaiting your return. She said presents are magically starting to appear under the Christmas tree again, so it looks like a double-barreled Christmas." "You can't beat a deal like that," Anders replied. "How was Christmas at your house today?" "Early and busy as usual," Collins said. "I told Michael you guys are up there, and he said, 'Who's driving?'" Michael was Collins's 5-year-old son. "That's a good question," Anders replied. "I think Isaac Newton is doing most of the driving right now." Collins informed the crew that Borman's family was at Mission Control. Susan did not want to distract her husband. Instead, she and her boys, and Frank's parents, just beamed their grins to Collins. "You've got a whole row of smiling faces in the back room, Frank," he said. A few minutes later, the Borman family left to return home. Only then did the public affairs officer announce to the media that a message had been forwarded by NASA that morning to Mrs. Lloyd Booker, wife of the captain of the USS Pueblo, whose crew had been held captive by North Korea. The message read, "You have been in our thoughts and prayers. Your reunion has brought great joy to our hearts this Christmas. Our best to you personally and to all the families under your command. Signed, the families of the crew of Apollo 8. The note, the public affairs officer said, had been Susan Borman's idea, and she'd written it herself. Shortly before going live on TV, Borman got ready to institute the planned mid-course correction. At an altitude of about 193,000 miles above Earth, he positioned the ship and fired its thrusters for 14 seconds. In a short time, planners in Houston would know how much the burn had helped. But already they could see that the trans-Earth injection maneuver used by the crew to leave lunar orbit had been nearly perfect. 24 minutes after the mid-course burn, Apollo 8 went live on the air. It was 3:15 p.m. Houston time, Christmas Day. The first pictures were of the spacecraft's complex instrument panel, then of Borman in his commander's seat. In front of him, a pair of legs floated upside down. "Well, good afternoon," Borman said. "This is the Apollo 8 crew." "It looks like you're okay, but somebody else is upside down," Collins said. "Okay, that's right. That's Jim Lovell," Borman said, as if there was nothing unusual about that. "What we thought we'd do today was just show you a little bit about life inside Apollo 8. We've shown you the scenes of the moon, scenes of the Earth, and we thought we'd invite you into our home." Anders, working the camera, followed Lovell into the lower equipment bay where Lovell gave a demonstration of how the crew exercised and bumped his head on navigation equipment, a detail Borman didn't fail to point out. Borman showed the command module's computer and its input keypad, then changed cameras to show Anders, who demonstrated how the crew ate in space, his meal floating before him. "The food that we use is all dehydrated. It comes prepackaged in vacuum-sealed bags," Borman explained. "You notice that all Bill has to do to keep it in one place is let go of it. Except for the air currents in the spacecraft, it would stay perfectly still. He gets out his handy-dandy scissors and cuts the bag. The food is varied, generally pretty good. If that doesn't sound like a rousing endorsement, it isn't, but nevertheless, it's pretty good food." Anders's dinner sounded appealing enough. Corn chowder, chicken and gravy, sugar cookies, orange drink, and hot cocoa. He showed how to use scissors to open the freeze-dried orange beverage, inject water, and make it drinkable. The men smiled and made jokes. Lovell showed off his navigation gear. Borman wished everyone back home a Merry Christmas. Anders zoomed in for a close-up of Lovell's mission patch, the one showing a figure eight around the Earth and the moon. Then, the screen went blank. Even a few days ago, that design had seemed the fancy of a science fiction writer. Today, it had almost all come true. After the broadcast, the crew broke out their own Christmas dinner. Each man expected more of what Anders had shown the world, dehydrated kibble. But that is not what they found. Wrapped in colorful holiday ribbons, fireproof, of course, and labeled with Merry Christmas messages, they uncovered a bounty. Roast turkey with gravy so thick it didn't even levitate from the tray. Stuffing, cranberry sauce. The topper was a gift smuggled in by Slayton himself. A 2-ounce bottle of Coronet VSQ California brandy, 100 proof, for each man. "Put it back," Borman ordered when he saw the liquor. If anything went wrong during the remainder of the flight, no matter how minor, the media would blame it on drinking. And there was no way Borman would risk that. Lovell just smiled. He and Anders had no intention of consuming the brandy. Still, he thought Slayton's gesture was just about the greatest thing in the world. The men had just been to the moon. The moon! And a little romance was called for. No matter. It was enough just to look at the bottle's red and brown label, admire its fancy script. Connoisseurs will delight, it promised, and dream of California, where the brandy had been awarded first prize at the state fair. Each man's wife had sent along a Christmas package for her husband. NASA requirements, small, fireproof, under 8 ounces. And now it was time for those to be opened. Lovell received cufflinks and a tie tack with a moonstone. Anders, a tie tack emblazoned with a gold numeral 8. And Borman, a set of cufflinks fashioned from a St. Christopher medal worn by a family friend during battle in World War I. The men often dressed formally for official engagements, so the gifts would come in handy. There was another set of cufflinks on board. 20 years earlier, as a plebe at the Naval Academy, Lovell had attended the Army-Navy football game in Philadelphia. There, he met another plebe, just for a moment in passing, this one an Army man from West Point. The two strangers exchanged one of their 2 cufflinks. It was only years later that Lovell learned that the man with whom he'd traded was Ed White, who'd also become an astronaut and who'd died in the Apollo 1 fire. To honor their friendship, Lovell had brought his own mismatched set of cufflinks to the moon. The crew had a long stretch ahead of them, and the flight plan allowed for more downtime than it had for the outbound journey or the orbits at the moon. That gave the men time to rest and to reflect on the journey they had taken. To each of them, Earth still appeared tiny, just a far-off speck in an endless galaxy. To each of them, it seemed a miracle that all the events and conditions necessary for life had come together in just the right way at just the right time to create their home planet, and that they had gotten lucky enough to be part of it for just the briefest moment in the universe's still unfolding story. Chapter 23. Help from an Old Friend. Borman climbed into his hammock for much-needed sleep, and Anders took control of the spacecraft. He found himself a bit bored. After discovering the moon, even a swan dive to Earth could pale in comparison. 1,000-mile intervals ticked by as if counted off by metronome. All was steady. While Anders controlled the spacecraft, Lovell took sextant sightings. Part of how Apollo 8 kept its attitude, the way it was oriented in space, was by aligning itself with the stars. To do that, Lovell would pick out known stars, then mark their positions through the onboard sextant. The computer would calculate the ship's attitude based on its relative position to those stars and automatically fire the ship's thrusters in order to keep its position in the desired orientation. It wasn't just important to be pointed toward Earth. It was important for Apollo 8 to be positioned the right way while it followed that path, especially upon re-entry into the atmosphere, when its orientation had to be perfect. Lovell had become a maestro at this job, shooting stars, entering data, and aiming the sextant like a concert pianist playing a Steinway. In fact, Lovell had earned the nickname Golden Fingers for his proficiency at punching these keys. But he was human, and not immune to a bad note. Early on December 25th, Houston time, Lovell missed a step. He meant to enter Program 23 and then select Star 01. Instead, he entered Program 01 into his computer. An alarm rang out. Suddenly, Apollo 8's guidance system reset itself, losing all memory of how the ship was oriented in space. As a result of Lovell's mistake, the guidance system now believed Apollo 8 to be back on the launch pad at Cape Kennedy. No one, not the crew, not the computer, not Houston, knew which way was up anymore. Anders checked the 8-ball, the attitude indicator that showed the spacecraft's orientation relative to the celestial sphere, and saw it moving and thumping in ways it shouldn't. At the same time, he heard one of the spacecraft's thrusters fire. Instantly, he was transported back to 1966 when he'd been on duty as Capcom for Gemini 8, the mission that had gone terribly wrong when a thruster could not be shut down, causing the ship to go into a violent and ever-accelerating tumble. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott had fought to stay conscious and regain control, which they finally managed by disabling the primary system and firing a set of reserve thrusters. As Anders saw the eight ball on his own spacecraft spin, he believed the same to be happening to Apollo 8. To counteract the rotation, Anders used his hand-controlled thruster, but the ball just kept moving. So Anders added more thrust. Soon, the spacecraft was in full rotation, and it was anyone's guess which way the nose was pointing in the cosmos. By now, Borman had awoken from the commotion. "What the hell's going on?" he called out. "Stuck thruster," Anders answered. But what to do? Armstrong and Scott had been in Earth orbit when it happened to them, and they barely made it out alive. Here, 185,000 miles farther away, it might be impossible to pull Apollo 8 out of its tumble and get it pointed back toward home. Anders had stared down Soviet bombers, had landed on sheets of ice in his fighter planes, and always he'd run cool. This scared the hell out of him. He looked back at the eight ball to assess the spin. Now it had frozen and was therefore useless. Yet the spacecraft was still turning. Anders knew it because he could see the cabin rotating against the pattern of sunlit dust motes floating freely inside it. By now, Lovell had called to Anders and Borman that he'd made a mistake by resetting the guidance system. That explained why the eight ball had rotated to its launch orientation, and that explained why a thruster was not the problem. The thruster Anders had heard had fired automatically by program, a coincidence. Furious at Lovell's mistake, Borman made his way to the control area, but already Anders had begun to fight the spacecraft's role. He couldn't use the seized-up eight ball to judge how to rotate the ship, so he turned to a more ancient instrument the men had on board. The dust. Firing his thrusters, Anders turned Apollo 8 just enough to move the cabin back in the direction of the floating dust particles. When the cabin no longer moved in relation to its interior dust, he knew the spacecraft had stopped rotating. Apollo 8 was now in a steady attitude, but no one knew which way it was pointed, and the guidance system still said the ship was on the launch pad. Borman took the controls. In an airplane, a pilot could eyeball the horizon and his runway and his surroundings if his instruments failed. Astronauts far from Earth couldn't do that. Borman and Anders now worried deeply about their ability to be sure of the spacecraft's attitude as they approached re-entry. It was crucial that Apollo 8 be properly oriented by the time they hit the atmosphere in order to make a safe entry back into the world. Everyone was angry. Borman and Anders at Lovell, Lovell at himself. It was a life-or-death situation. If they could not figure out how to reorient the spacecraft, Apollo 8 might not survive. The best idea, they agreed, was to use the stars. If they could pick out just a few they knew, they could begin rebuilding the computer's idea of their orientation. Out the windows, the sun shone against an all-black cosmos. Borman, Lovell, and Anders strained to locate stars, but crystals from the ship's evaporators, along with crystals from their own urine, followed the spacecraft, all of them masquerading as stars. Even when the astronauts thought they could distinguish between these tag-along crystals and a genuine star, it was impossible for them to identify the star, which was necessary for the computer to do its thinking. It was then that Lovell found help from an old friend. Looking through the spacecraft's optical system, he spotted the moon. Then, locating Earth, he began to form a rough idea of the spacecraft's attitude with respect to the 37 stars stored in the computer's database. Now, when he saw a star out the window, he could make an educated guess about its identity. If the crew still didn't know exactly how they were positioned in the heavens, at least they knew the neighborhood. On the ground, Collins began to relay the procedures that would help the crew regain an accurate attitude reference for the ship. Mission Control was given access to a part of the computer's memory that had been corrupted by Lovell's mistake. In particular, a set of numbers that defined how the guidance platform ought to be aligned with the stars. Once Houston had uploaded the correct values, Lovell began a process of righting the ship, rotating it and sighting on stars until, after about half an hour, the men understood again how their spacecraft stood in relation to the universe around them and to home. It was just after 9 o'clock on Christmas night in Houston when Mission Control offered another gift to the astronauts, one they'd been planning for some time. In place of the usual beeps and technical talk, NASA beamed up a recording of Joy to the World by Percy Faith and his orchestra. Anders got a chill when it played. The music seemed to be coming from every direction, almost divine. Then he heard O Holy Night, but as the spacecraft turned in barbecue mode, the sound became warped. Anders had become so entranced by the music, he'd forgotten to switch over between Apollo 8's various antennas. Tuned wrongly in space, even Christmas music could become eerie. A few hours later, Anders reported that the crew had seen the moon only once during its journey home. They were now 150,000 miles from Earth and 90,000 miles from the moon. 5 hours after that, they were 20,000 miles closer to home and traveling about 3,800 miles per hour. By now, Apollo 8 had been in flight for more than 5 full days. Borman jokingly told Houston that they should spread out one of those banners in the Pacific Ocean splashdown area and that Apollo 8 would try to coast through it. 24 hours remained until scheduled splashdown. Around 5 o'clock Houston time on the afternoon of December 26th, after almost a full day of uneventful cruising, Apollo 8 reached the halfway point between the moon and Earth. It had been 37 hours since they left the moon, but if all went well, it would take just another 20 hours to reach the Pacific Ocean. The astronauts had one television broadcast left when they would address a nation growing ever more nervous about their safe re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. Marilyn Lovell was nervous, too. She grabbed her two eldest children, Barbara and Jay, and whisked them to Mission Control where they could all watch. As they arrived, they heard Jim poke a little fun at himself. "I tried to hurry up the voyage home by calling up Program 01 to get us back on the pad, but it didn't work," he radioed to Houston. "Well, that's the best excuse I've heard so far, Jim," Carr replied. "The best of many," Lovell said. A few minutes later, while millions of Americans watched, the crew of Apollo 8 began its sixth and final scheduled television broadcast. For nearly a minute, almost nothing appeared on screen as Anders tried to frame the shot. But then, a planet emerged, half-lit, half-in-darkness, and there was no mistaking the swirls of clouds, the grooves of continents, the scoops of oceans. This was Earth, from 110,000 miles away. This, every person could see, was where they lived. Lovell pointed to a storm over South America, the waters around the West Indies and Florida. Looking through his telescope, he said he could see the central and southern United States. He asked Anders to describe his view. "As I look down on the Earth here from so far out in space," Anders said, "I think I must have the feeling that the travelers in the old sailing ships used to have. Going on a very long voyage away from home, and now we're headed back. And I have that feeling of being proud of the trip, but still happy to be going back home and back to our home port." 19 hours remained until Apollo 8's scheduled re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. With no major milestones due between now and then, the media was hungry for stories, and they turned to the astronauts' families to find them. Valerie Anders reported that she was locked to her squawk box. Her son Alan was playing with his dog, Luna, and cat, Dudley, while the other Anders kids concentrated on their Christmas presents. Valerie also noted that 10-year-old Glenn had mowed the lawn that morning, a job Bill had given him before leaving. Marilyn Lovell reported that she was trying to recover from all the excitement of the past several days. She told how daughter Susan had been jumping on her pogo stick. Susan Borman said she'd spent much of the morning cleaning the house for friends who would join her for re-entry and splashdown, and for Frank's return home. She noted that her two sons, 17-year-old Fred and 15-year-old Ed, would be helping her with cleanup duties. There was a reason for that. Earlier that day, away from home, Fred and Ed had gotten into a fight, and Ed broke his left thumb throwing a punch to Fred's head. The boys knew this would be a problem and swore each other to secrecy. When they returned home, Ed walked around, hiding his hand from Susan, but the pain only grew worse. The boys sneaked out of the house, drove to NASA, and found a doctor who x-rayed Ed's hand. A short time later, Ed left wearing a giant white cast that reached halfway up his forearm. There would be no hiding that from their mother. When they returned home, Susan was angry that they could even think of fighting as their father plummeted toward Earth. At the same time, she was proud that they'd figured out how to handle the problem themselves. Helping her clean would be light penance. About 3 hours after the television broadcast, Susan, Marilyn, and Valerie found rides to the home of astronaut Fred Hayes, one of Apollo 8's backup crew, where a get-together, hosted by his wife, Mary, was underway. These gatherings had become a tradition during space flights, and 40 other astronaut wives welcomed the Apollo 8 ladies with ice cream and homemade cookies. Reporters dubbed the event a hen party. Several hours after the wives returned home, Apollo 8 was just 35,000 miles from the Pacific Ocean and had increased its speed to 7,700 miles per hour. By now it was clear to Mission Control that the 14-second mid-course correction burn done a day ago had been so accurate that no further trajectory corrections would be needed. Backup recovery forces in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans were sent home. It would now be the Pacific Ocean or bust. 4 hours remained until scheduled splashdown. NASA's public affairs officer noted unusually high traffic in congratulatory messages flooding into the agency. The New York Times proclaimed, "There was more than narrow religious significance in the emotional high point of their fantastic odyssey, their reading of the biblical story of creation, while this world watched live pictures of the moon televised by the astronauts from within a few dozen miles of the lunar surface." Even acting NASA chief Thomas Paine couldn't contain himself. As the spacecraft drew closer to Earth, he wrote to President Johnson, "It is apparent that an unprecedented wave of popular enthusiasm for the Apollo 8 astronauts is building up around the world. Laudatory editorials are in every paper." Many were already calling the mission the greatest adventure in mankind's history. But the ship wasn't home yet. Apollo 8 still had to hit the narrowest of entry corridors at just the right attitude, moving at speeds faster than humans had ever traveled. To Borman and his crewmates, re-entry was one of the three maneuvers on the mission, along with launch and trans-Earth injection, during which they were most likely to die. Re-entry into Earth's atmosphere would officially start at an altitude of 400,000 feet, or 75.75 miles. Nothing magical happened at that point, but it's where things would start to change in a hurry. By that time, the command module would have shed the service module, leaving Apollo 8 just a cone-shaped wedge about 11 feet tall and 13 feet wide, speeding through space. Several seconds later, Apollo 8 would have plunged 100,000 more feet, and Earth's atmosphere would begin acting on the ship and on the crew, exerting just a tiny fraction of a single G-force. The spacecraft would be traveling in excess of 24,500 miles per hour, and the computer would take over flying duties from Borman. At that point, the astronauts could only trust that Apollo 8 was aimed and positioned right. Some had compared NASA's challenge in finding the entry corridor to throwing a paper airplane into a public mailbox slot. From a distance of 4 miles, there was almost no margin for error. If the spacecraft came in too steep, it would grind too hard into the atmosphere, causing massive G-forces that would crush the ship and crew, and generating heat so intense it would incinerate the men and turn Apollo 8 into a burning meteor. If it came in too shallow, it would bounce off the atmosphere like a stone skipped on water and coast back out into space. Without the service module, Apollo 8 lacked any means of propulsion and could not apply the brakes sufficiently to re-enter Earth's atmosphere. At that point, each astronaut would have a chat with his wife and children before drifting away from Earth in a ship with only a few hours life support to embark on a long elliptical orbit, one that would be fatal. But even if the spacecraft hit the entry corridor perfectly, the friction created by the drag of the atmosphere on an object moving at almost 25,000 miles per hour would generate temperatures of 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. To enable the astronauts to survive it, the command module had been covered by a heat shield made of a reinforced phenolic resin injected into a fiberglass honeycomb. Rather than defeat the heat in combat, the shield was designed to succumb to it and then vaporize away, leaving a new layer of shield beneath to continue the fight, all while keeping the command module cool. Even if it worked and the astronauts weren't fried to a crisp, they would be undergoing tremendous G-forces as the atmosphere slowed the ship. They would also lose all communications with Earth as gases around the spacecraft ionized from the shockwave, creating a kind of wall through which radio signals could not pass. To mitigate the fantastic amount of heat and G-forces caused by re-entry, Apollo 8 wouldn't simply plunge through the atmosphere. Rather, it would use its aerodynamic design, its slightly off-center weight distribution, turned the spacecraft into a kind of wing, allowing it to achieve lift and dip up and down, extend its path, shed velocity, and diffuse the heat that it had to endure as it aimed for the designated landing site. The whole process would take about 5 minutes. If all went well, the spacecraft would have slowed enough to make its final drop to Earth. The astronauts' lives would then depend on the command module's parachute system and the recovery forces that even now moved back and forth in the Pacific Ocean near Hawaii like predatory big cats on the hunt. 1 hour remained until re-entry. It was before dawn at the splashdown site, about 1,000 miles southwest of Hawaii. It would still be dark when Apollo 8 arrived. Traveling at 12,500 miles per hour, about 11,000 miles above Earth, the astronauts stowed the last items still loose aboard the spacecraft. Given the huge G-forces of re-entry and the jarring of the impact with the water, it was critical for the crew not to allow anything loose that could damage the cabin or themselves. 30 minutes later, network television interrupted regular programming to cover re-entry and splashdown. In Houston, it was just past 9 o'clock a.m. on December 27th. All three astronauts' wives were watching their televisions at home, listening with one ear to the network anchor, the other to a squawk box. Inside the spacecraft, the crew cut off the oxygen flow from the service module, which they would soon leave behind. Their capsule now depended on its own small tanks for oxygen, a supply that wouldn't last much longer than the time required for a successful re-entry and splashdown. Borman checked to confirm that the spacecraft was in its proper attitude. 15 minutes before the planned re-entry, Borman engaged a pyrotechnic sequence that severed cables and connections between the command and service modules, then blew apart the tendons that kept the two modules connected. A violent jolt that shook the astronauts. The service module had been Apollo 8's lifeline, housed its SPS engine, made every mile of this historic journey. Its built-in jets fired to thrust it away from the command module, lighting the sky in a final goodbye. Only 6 minutes remained until re-entry. Even now, the astronauts didn't wear their spacesuits or helmets, and wouldn't the rest of the way, a decision NASA had allowed so that the crew could equalize their eardrums manually as the pressure in the spacecraft rose during its descent through the atmosphere. Inside the cabin, the crew was pointed backward and upside down, the windowed nose of the module facing back out toward space as they hurtled, still weightless and strapped in, at more than 20,000 miles per hour toward Earth's atmosphere. At launch, 6 days and 2 hours earlier, Apollo 8 weighed 6.2 million pounds. Now, just 12,000 of those pounds remained. Looking out his window, Borman got a send-off from an old, familiar face. "Look who's coming there, would you?" he said. "What?" Lovell asked. "The moon." A minute later, Borman checked his indicators. "Well, men, we're getting close." "There's no turning back now," Anders said. "Old Mother Earth has us," Lovell said. 2 minutes later, Anders noticed a change in the view outside his window. "What is that?" he asked. Borman and Lovell, the old spaceflight pros, decided to have a little fun with the rookie. "That's right, you've never seen the air glow. Take a look at it," Lovell said. "You can't get your astronaut pin without seeing the air glow," Borman said. Apollo 8 plunged, blunt end first, toward Earth, at more than 24,750 miles per hour, breaking below 100 miles altitude and pushing its crew faster than any humans ever had traveled. On board, the astronauts, seated with their backs to the direction of travel, began to feel the first drag from the atmosphere and could see the dark sky begin to ionize and glow around them. Borman and Lovell might have experienced re-entry before, but never at these speeds. They weren't kidding with Anders anymore.
"That's the air glow we're starting to get. That's what it is, gentlemen," Lovell said.
The three men braced themselves.
"Goddamn," Borman said. "This is going to be a real ride. Hang on."
Chapter 24. The Men Who Saved 1968. The world outside the spacecraft lit up even before the astronauts expected it.
"I've never seen it this bright before," Borman told his crewmates. "You got 0.05G yet?"
0.05G, Lovell answered,
checking a readout on the console.
"Okay, we got it," Anders called.
The spacecraft neared 25,000 miles per hour.
"Hang on," Borman yelled.
Out his window, Lovell could see a pink glow turning brighter by the second, and he felt the G-forces building. Temperatures rose fast around the command module as it collided with the atmosphere. The crew could only hope the heat shield would do its job. No manned ship had ever endured the heat loads Apollo 8 was about to experience. A second later, Houston lost contact with the spacecraft as Apollo 8 became enveloped in ionized gas. On CBS, Walter Cronkite narrated over an animated rendering of the command module entering a fiery atmosphere. At their homes, the astronauts' wives watched the broadcasts, willing their husbands home in these hand-drawn capsules. Inside the spacecraft, the G-forces increased fast.
"They're building up," Lovell called.
"Call out the G's," Borman told him.
"We're 1G," Lovell answered.
The men's labored breathing could be heard on their intercom system as the forces multiplied.
"Oh,"
Lovell groaned.
"Five,"
he called, straining to speak.
"Six."
Cronkite explained to the nation what the astronauts were enduring.
"Seven G's is seven times their weight on Earth, so these 150-pound astronauts weigh something like 1,050 pounds, would be the effect, as they are pressed against their couches."
Apollo 8 crashed even harder into the atmosphere. Despite the G-forces making it difficult to move or even breathe, the ride was smoother than on liftoff, and the astronauts could still look out their windows and see the pink gases of the ionizing atmosphere turn a deeper, reddish blue. To Anders, he and his crewmates looked like flies caught in the middle of a blowtorch flame. In the distance, a Pan Am pilot flying in the darkness from Hawaii to Fiji watched the fireball created by Apollo 8 and estimated its comet-like tail to be more than 100 miles long.
Moments later, at maximum G-force load, the inferno surrounding the astronauts turned pure white as the temperature at the surface of the spacecraft rose to half that of the surface of the sun. Out his window, Anders saw a terrifying sight. Baseball-sized chunks of the heat shield flying off, many times larger than the grain-sized pieces NASA expected, and he waited for the heat to sear through the spacecraft and melt the crew. But Apollo 8 did not melt. Instead, after about a minute of this peak intensity, the onboard computer automatically began to roll the spacecraft. Though the ship had no wings, its designed shape and offset center of mass made it capable of lift, if positioned correctly, and now it began to climb a bit back out of the atmosphere, lowering the G-forces and cooling down in the process. "Cabin temperature is still holding real good," Anders called to his crewmates, sounding a bit astonished and relieved. "Quite a ride, huh?" "Damnedest thing I ever saw," Borman said. 3 minutes after losing contact with the spacecraft, Houston began calling to the ship. But Capcom Ken Mattingly couldn't get through. Apollo 8 had swooped back down for its second grind into the atmosphere. The crew held on. "How much will this one go up, do you think?" Anders asked of the building G-forces. 3, Lovell called. 20 seconds or so later, the spacecraft had been slowed by the atmosphere to suborbital speeds and began rolling one way, then the other, as the computer steered them toward the recovery ships. It had been nearly 5 minutes since the crew lost contact with Houston, but now Lovell began calling home.
"Houston, Apollo 8, over."
Mattingly made out the voice through the static.
"Go ahead, Apollo 8, read you broken and loud." Borman jumped in. "Roger, this is a real fireball."
100,000 feet below, the USS Yorktown found Apollo 8 on its radar. A minute later, the spacecraft was at an altitude of just 40,000 feet and plummeting at a speed of about 680 miles per hour. At around 30,000 feet, an altitude sensor fired explosives to jettison the top of the heat shield at the pointy end of the spacecraft. A moment later, 2 drogue parachutes shot out of the ship, making a giant thwack that Borman heard as they streaked up into the sky. The ship jolted when their lines went taut. These were not the chutes that would lower the craft to the water, but rather the smaller ones designed to stabilize Apollo 8, to keep it from wobbling and make it ready for the primary chutes. By the time they were out, the spacecraft was just 20,000 feet above the Pacific, but now its descent rate had slowed. Inside the cabin, an air vent opened to equalize inside and outside pressures. Falling at a speed of 300 miles per hour, Apollo 8 rode gravity until an altitude of 10,000 feet, when the 3 main 80-foot parachutes were deployed. When their lines pulled tight, the spacecraft jerked hard. Anders worried that he'd felt only 1 jerk, not 3. He knew that the Soviets had experienced trouble with their parachutes and that the technology, in general, was unreliable. Neither he nor the others could see the parachutes in the dark, but when Borman and Lovell checked their instruments, they could tell that the craft's sink rate had declined significantly, indicating proper functioning of all 3 chutes. With the red and white parachutes fully blossomed, Apollo 8's descent rate fell to just 19 miles per hour. On board, thrusters were ignited and their tanks purged of propellant to prevent harmful substances from polluting the splashdown and recovery area. The fire spitting from the burning thrusters lit the still dark sky, giving the astronauts their first view of their parachutes, and good reason to believe they were floating down as planned. Under the chute's risers, the capsule was tipped on an angle to allow it to knife into the water rather than belly flop onto its blunt base. At an altitude of just 8,000 feet, Apollo 8 was less than 5 minutes from scheduled impact with the water. Moments later, one of the recovery aircraft made radio contact with the spacecraft.
"Welcome home, gentlemen," a crewman called to the astronauts, "and we'll have you aboard in no time." At 3 minutes to splashdown, recovery helicopters spotted flashing beacons from the falling spacecraft. Apollo 8 was almost directly over the Yorktown, a bullseye of almost unimaginable accuracy. "Stand by for Earth landing," Borman called from his commander's seat. At their homes in Houston, the astronauts' wives stared at their televisions. For Valerie, it was thrilling to hear that the parachutes had opened. That meant Apollo 8 was somehow reconnected to Earth. But she thought, they're heading for a big, dark, rough ocean, and the ships still don't know where they are. At 1,000 feet altitude, radio traffic from the recovery forces grew so voluminous that the astronauts couldn't communicate with one another. "Turn him down," Anders told his partners. "Christ, we can't get anything done." Just 100 or so feet remained. The crew braced themselves, not knowing exactly when impact might come. Borman called to Lovell and Anders. "Maybe we better get these." At that moment, Apollo 8 came in flat, not on its intended angled knife edge, and bashed into the Pacific Ocean, its blunt end colliding against the upswell of a wave, just about the most violent impact possible. Inundated by water and perhaps stunned by the crash, Borman could not flip the switch to cut the parachutes from the capsule, and Apollo 8 was dragged over by its chutes and turned upside down in the ocean. None of the men was ready for an impact that jarring. Nothing in simulation had come close. By the time Borman came around a few seconds later and cut the lines, all three men were hanging upside down in their straps. Garbage that had collected in the cabin streamed down on them, and water poured over their bodies and faces. Right away, the crew believed the spacecraft had split open from the impact and was flooding with seawater. Anders got ready to pounce on the hatch and open it, then get his crewmates and himself out before the ship sank. They'd trained for that kind of emergency. But a moment later, he could see that no more water was running in, and he realized that the crew had been doused not by seawater, but by condensation around the various cold parts of the spacecraft's interior. Anders could only smile at the picture. Three conquering heroes returned from the moon, hanging upside down and dripping in garbage. Borman reached for a button and inflated three large balloons, which flipped the spacecraft back over, blunt side down. The men were now right side up in their seats, but it was too late. Sickened by the impact, the high seas, and the sudden inversion, Borman vomited all over his crewmates. It had been bad enough on the outbound journey when Borman threw up, but now his crewmates let him have it. "Typical Army guy," the two Navy men yelled at their commander. "Can't handle the water." Television cameras showed live images from the recovery ship and one of the rescue helicopters. Cronkite removed his glasses, as if he couldn't quite believe the journey had ended. "The spacecraft, Apollo 8, is back. And what a remarkable trip and remarkable conclusion," he told the nation. "The spacecraft has landed within 2¾ miles of the carrier. Apollo 8 has ended up to this point as perfectly as it began." At home, the astronauts' wives were overcome by joy, relief, and wonder. Their children hugged their crying mothers. At mission control, applause broke out, and a 15-foot-long American flag was unfurled, one that eclipsed the giant wall map that had been used for the mission. All three flight shifts were present to experience the moment. The Star-Spangled Banner played in everyone's headsets. "It is a veritable roar in here," the public affairs officer announced. "The room is awash with cigar smoke. A number of congratulatory messages are coming across this console. I've never seen a degree of this emotional outpouring in any previous mission, including Alan Shepard's. I've seen rallies in locker rooms after championship games, happy politicians after elections, but never, none of them, do justice to the spirit pervading this room." Some of the controllers and personnel had also brought along triangular flags with a white numeral 1 sewn in to indicate victory over the Soviets. Someone at NASA, however, suggested that that might not be the most magnanimous of displays, and the men agreed. Instead, they waved American flags, which to many of them said it all.
In Rome, Pope Paul VI, who'd watched the splashdown on television, knelt in a prayer of gratitude. In communist Cuba, state news covered the return of the spacecraft. World leaders began writing notes of congratulations to America. In the capsule, Borman, Lovell, and Anders were still covered in vomit and garbage. The spacecraft had come through unimaginable heat with almost no effect on cabin temperatures, but now, bobbing on the waves, it began to grow hot inside, likely from retained heat sizzling upon impact with the water. Temperatures soon subsided, however, and Anders began to appreciate how beautifully the heat shield had worked. The huge chunks he'd seen flying off during re-entry had really been just granular in size, surrounded by an ionized haze and streaking by at thousands of miles per hour, they had appeared through his window like fiery baseballs. The crew worked to remove their straps while helicopters circled above. Recovery forces itched to get to work, but NASA protocol required them to wait for the break of dawn and the onset of natural light in about 45 minutes. So all they could do was hover, close in, and shine lights around the bobbing capsule. Men armed with rifles scanned the waters to make sure no sharks were in the area during recovery time. Just before first light, several swimmers dropped from their chopper into the water. When they reached Apollo 8, they affixed an inflatable collar to the spacecraft, stabilizing it and providing a platform on which to step and work. Through a window, one of the swimmers flashed a thumbs up to Anders, who returned the gesture. While the Yorktown moved toward the recovery scene, one of the helicopter pilots radioed the astronauts with a question. "Is the moon really made of green cheese?" "No," Anders replied. "It's made of American cheese." Soon after, the Yorktown called to the capsule asking what the astronauts might like for breakfast. The answer was unanimous. Biscuits, steak, and eggs. As daylight broke, three swimmers worked to open the spacecraft's hatch. When it lifted, one of the swimmers stuck his head inside, only to recoil as if repelled by a force field. He soon found his feet, and along with the others helped the crew of Apollo 8 out of the capsule. As they stepped onto the inflatable platform around the spacecraft, none of the three astronauts could imagine a smell sweeter than the fresh sea air, a smell they'd known forever and yet was new to them today. A helicopter dropped a life raft into the water, and one by one the astronauts climbed inside. The helicopter then lowered a basket-shaped net for the crew. One at a time, they were hoisted into the chopper. Anders was the last to go. Looking up at the helicopter, it struck him that almost everything on Apollo 8 had been designed with great redundancy, yet here he was, at the very end of his journey, hanging over the ocean by a single wire. It was 11:14 a.m. Houston time when the helicopter closed its door. Looking back down toward his spacecraft, Borman gave thanks to the scalded machine, an exquisite piece of design and daring. A moment later, the chopper dipped its shoulder into the yellow-pink new sky and headed for the Yorktown. On the carrier, hundreds of crew, dressed in navy whites, jammed the decks, eager for a glimpse of the returning pioneers. On board the helicopter, a crewman handed Borman an electric razor. NASA had figured out how to get three men to the moon and back again, but still hadn't perfected technology that would allow men to shave without polluting the command module with stubble. When Borman had asked to arrive at the aircraft carrier clean-shaven, a portable electric razor on board the chopper was the best NASA could offer. Soon, Borman was whisker-free. On television sets at their homes, Susan, Marilyn, and Valerie watched as the helicopter slowed to a hover over the deck of the Yorktown and then set down. Ship's crews ran out, ducking their heads to secure the chopper to the deck. After the rotors stopped, a short stair platform was brought to the aircraft door, and a red carpet was unrolled at the foot of the stairs. The door opened, and the three astronauts stepped forward, first Borman, then Lovell, then Anders. They smiled and waved, overwhelmed by the roar of the hundreds of sailors on board the ship, each of whom was away from home for Christmas, just as they were. A giant American flag held by the Navy color guard danced in the ocean breeze. In the sound and the moment, Borman's mind traveled back in time, over all the training and planning that had been done for Apollo 8, over the thousands of people who had worked so hard for this audacious mission. And he thought about how so few of them would ever be recognized like this, and how so many of them deserved to be. Anders lost his balance for a moment when the astronauts finally made their way down the stairs, not an unexpected result after more than 6 days of weightlessness. Watching at home, Valerie thought that her husband looked skinny. It was the smiles that convinced the women that their husbands really were home safe. By now, Marilyn was so spent from the stress of the past week that she had little voice left and even less energy. But she couldn't remember ever feeling so happy. "He's beautiful," she did manage to tell reporters. "I know that's no way to describe a man, but he looks just beautiful."
At a nearby microphone, the Yorktown's commander, Captain John Fifield, welcomed and congratulated the men. Taking the microphone, Borman addressed the ship. Millions of people watched around the world. "We're just very happy to be here and appreciate all your efforts. And I know you had to stay out here over Christmas, and that made it tough. We can't tell you how much we really appreciate you being here and how proud it is for us to participate in this event, because thousands of people made this possible. And I guess we're all just part of the group. Thank you very much." Surrounded by sailors, the astronauts made their way across the flight deck, then down an elevator to the hangar deck and into the ship's sick bay for a medical evaluation. For his part, Anders was in no shape for an inspection. As part of his plan to avoid defecating in space, he'd asked NASA doctors to prescribe a low-residue diet before and during the flight, and his plan had worked so well that he hadn't had a bowel movement during the entire mission. Now, he needed to find a toilet. He located a cabin just in time. As nature began to have its say, there was a pounding on the bathroom door. "Major Anders, quick, you've got to come to Flag Bridge. The president is going to call in 5 minutes. Move it." Anders was torn between his duties. He could only answer to the higher power. "I'm not going," Anders yelled to the man. "Tell him I'm on the toilet and I'm not going." There was no way Anders could risk losing control of himself while talking to the President of the United States. A minute later, one of the ship's doctors ran in with a portable telephone and passed it through the bathroom door to Anders. Borman and Lovell picked up their own extensions, likely in sick bay, surrounded by physicians, stethoscopes, and syringes. Less than a month remained in Johnson's presidency. 5 years earlier, he'd taken over from his slain predecessor, a president who'd made an impossible promise: to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. Johnson might have been forgiven for backing off Kennedy's commitment. Instead, he'd charged forward. "You've seen what man has really never seen before," Johnson said to the astronauts. "You've taken all of us, all over the world, and into a new era. And my thoughts this morning went back to more than 10 years ago, when we saw Sputnik racing through the skies and we realized that America had a big job ahead of it. It gave me so much pleasure to know that you men have done a large part of that job." And it gave Borman, especially, the same kind of pleasure. He'd gone to the moon because of his love of country and because he felt it was important to beat the Soviets in the race to get there. He'd always told himself his mission wouldn't be done until he and his crewmates were standing on the carrier deck. Putting down the telephone after speaking with President Johnson, he knew he'd made it. After the call, 17 doctors, researchers, and medical technicians inspected the astronauts, taking blood, conducting tests, making sure all was well. Even a psychiatrist got his turn, looking for signs that such profound separation from home and family and Earth might have disturbed the men's psyches. Other than some stiff legs, and Lovell's lingering tendency to let go of things in midair and expect them to float, everyone checked out fine.
Following their medical examinations, the crew were allowed to phone their wives. Even from a distance of several thousand miles and through the thick static, these women never sounded so close. The astronauts made their way back to the flight deck to thank the crew of the Yorktown and to meet with the swimmers who'd made the recovery. While shaking hands,